I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
This episode contains the topics of murder and violence. Listener discretion is advised. In today's case, we will be discussing violence against women. If you are in need of support, CanadianWomen.org has a list of shelters, other services, and information that may be helpful. Also, ShelterSafe.ca is an online resource to help women and their children seeking safety from violence and abuse. If you or someone you know is in immediate danger, please contact emergency services. Welcome to Momicide Podcast. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Kristen.
And in today's episode, we will be discussing the case of Paula Gallant, which is a case very close to home for us. So this case happened just outside of Halifax, and it was a school teacher who was murdered. And this happened in 2005. So I don't know about you, but I remember it being on the news.
I do remember hearing something about it. It's definitely jogging my memory, but I really don't know too much about this one. So Amanda's definitely going to be breaking it down for me and giving me the details. But yeah, I remember actually seeing people driving around with like her sticker.
Yeah, it's like
on the car,
cursive P for yeah, Paula.
Yeah, and I remember my mom pointing it out and being like, "Oh, that's that teacher that was like killed."
This case also involves a Mr. Big Sting, which we haven't talked about yet, but I find these so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And for our Canadian listeners, you're probably familiar with them. But honestly, if you listen to true crime anyway, you've definitely heard of it before.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that happens only in Canada for the most part. So without further ado, we're going to get right into it.
Let's get into it.
Paula Gallant was a wife, mother, daughter, sister, aunt, and friend. She was an elementary school teacher who was adored by her students and colleagues, as well as a talented and dedicated artist. At 36 years old, just 2 days after Christmas in 2005, Paula was found beaten and strangled, left in the trunk of her car in the parking lot of the school at which she worked. As year by year passed, Paula's sisters struggled and fought to keep Paula Gallant's name in the media and to keep the search for the perpetrator alive. Eventually, it had been almost 5 years that had gone by, without any indication that Paula's killer would be found. At this point, to the community, it seemed as though the investigation had gone cold. However, unbeknownst to those outside the investigation, officers were working tirelessly behind the scenes to gather enough evidence to put Paula Gallant's murderer away. A case that would finally come to a close through the use of the Mr. Big operation, a tactic created in Canada which involves an intricate undercover investigation that's designed to uncover the truth surrounding a potential suspect. This investigation, which occurred over the course of 10 months, eventually led the perpetrator to elaborately confess to what they had done. This case is the story of two loving sisters who spent every waking day fighting for justice and to spread awareness of violence against women in Paula Gallant's memory. Paula Ann Gallant was born in Glace Bay, Nova Scotia on December 5, 1969. Paula was an active member of her community and workplace and was cherished by her students. It was said that she loved her job and her students and that she was creative, enthusiastic, and kind. In a social setting, Paula was described as funny, witty, and optimistic. She was the life of the party. Paula was a friend to many, but her relationship and friendship with her two sisters stood out. Her and her sisters would see and speak to one another daily, and they truly cherished each other. At the time of her murder, she was 36 years old. She was a dedicated mother to her 11-month-old daughter, Anna, who would turn a year old just 1 week later. Paula had been married to her husband, Jason McRae, for 2.5 years. The couple had met at a party in 2001 and hit it off. So here's a photo of Paula and Jason.
Her face is definitely ringing a bell now that I see it. By the time they were married, she would have been pregnant very shortly after that then, right?
Right. So they were only married for 2.5 years at the time, and their daughter was 11 months. Paula's husband, Jason, worked at a call center for Nova Scotia Power, and Paula taught grade 3 at Beachville Lakeside Timberley School, which I'll refer to as BLT. Paula had a passion for art, and at the time of her death, she was actually a student herself at Nova Scotia College for Art and Design, or NASCAD, in Halifax. She was studying visual arts. She was an artist in many ways. She loved to take photos of her family, make scrapbooks, and write stories that she would read to her daughter, Anna. So here's a photo of Paula and her daughter.
Aw, so cute.
Paula and her husband lived in their family home in Timberley, just outside of Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. However, the couple were in the process of buying a new home and had recently had an accepted offer. Paula was the youngest of the family with two older sisters, Lynn and Lana. Her parents, Paul and Diane Gallant, came from Ontario, but moved to Glace Bay, Cape Breton, in Nova Scotia before Paula was born. Paula's parents were loving, supportive, and cherished their family's bond. When Paula was only 16 years old, her father, Paul, died unexpectedly due to a brain aneurysm. The Gallant family was devastated by this, and unfortunately, only a few years later, when Paula was 19, she suddenly lost her mother, who also died of an aneurysm.
That's horrible.
To have died of the same thing as well, that's heartbreaking. Having suffered the tragic loss of both of their parents, the Gallant sisters clung to one another. They were able to continue on together, and the sisters became very close. As adults, all three of the sisters lived just a short distance away from one another outside of Halifax, Nova Scotia. They could be found supporting one another and their children during each holiday, birthday, concert, and game, and even took vacations together. They were godparents to one another's children, and it was rare for them to go a day without seeing or speaking to one another. People used to describe them as three peas in a pod. Paula's sister Lynn said, quote, "We had one of two paths to choose as young women, and we chose to stay together and live a good life, work hard, and try to bring laughter to people's souls." Paula Gallant's murder took place in late December of 2005. Over the holidays, Paula and her husband Jason were together with their daughter Anna on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and a large portion of Boxing Day at Paula's sister's family home, with both of her sisters, their husbands, and their children. On the morning of December 27th, Paula went to her sister Lana's home once again to visit, then ran an errand at a hardware store and returned home. She thawed chili for supper and did some painting and preparation for the sale of her house. This same day, December 27th, at around 7:30 p.m., Paula's husband, Jason, called her sister, Lana, to ask if she knew where Paula was or if she had spoken to her. Jason told Lana that Paula had left to go shopping at around 2 p.m. that afternoon. Lana told Jason that she had spoken to Paula over the phone at roughly 1:30 p.m., wherein Paula told her sister that she had no plans to go out that day. This conversation that Paula had with her sister was at this point her last known conversation prior to her disappearance. Paula's sister Lana headed to Paula and Jason's home, where she and Jason made calls to friends and family in an attempt to track Paula down. They also checked her online bank statements for any activity, but they found nothing. Jason set out to Costco, where he said Paula had gone to pick up diapers for their daughter Anna, but he didn't see her car in the parking lot. At 8:12 p.m., Jason then called the Halifax Regional Police looking for guidance. He indicated to police that Paula had left to go shopping but didn't return. At this point, Paula Gallant's family and friends became worried and they started to search. At 10:14 p.m., still with no sign of Paula, Jason called 911 to report his wife missing. Family and friends of Paula searched the community and surrounding areas. Among the friends and family conducting a search for Paula were her husband, Jason, her sister, Lana, her brother-in-laws, Paul Kenny and Alan Blackburn, and a close friend, Andrea McLean. While Paula's other sister, Lynn Blackburn, took care of her daughter, the group set out to the school where Paula Gallant worked, BLT Elementary School. Upon arrival at the school at 12:30 a.m. on December 28th, Paula's car, a 1997 Chevy Cavalier, was found to be in the parking lot with the doors locked. Wondering if she was inside, Jason and Paul ran frantically around the school, banging on the doors and windows, to no avail. When police arrived, along with a spare set of keys for Paula's car, the group made a gruesome discovery. Paula Gallant's body was found in the trunk of her car, lying in the fetal position, wrapped in a blanket. She was wearing jeans, a nylon windbreaker, and her shoes were removed and placed in the trunk next to her head. An initial note made by investigators was that Paula's attire was not appropriate for the freezing cold winter conditions in Nova Scotia in December, especially despite the fact that she had run some errands earlier that day and was dressed appropriately. Paula's purse and car keys were also found in the glove compartment. So here's a photo of the parking lot, and you can see the caution tape around the perimeter, and Paula's car had been removed at that point. Before the autopsy was released, Paula's memorial service, which was planned by her sisters, was held on January 2, 2006. Paula's husband, Jason, allegedly didn't participate in the planning nor the financial costs. Paula's memorial service and headstone cost over $5,500, which was covered by Lana and Lynn. At the funeral, donations were taken to support Paula and Jason's daughter, Anna.
So, I mean, obviously at this point, nobody knows who the killer is.
Right.
And I would think, you know, looking at her husband, Jason, and his actions, and, you know, is it like, okay, he's not helping out with the cost of this memorial is because he's just so grief-stricken and we're just going to swoop in and we'll take care of it so that he has less to worry about right now because he's already dealing with enough.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it he's not helping because he just doesn't care?
Yeah, those are two reasonable conclusions to make, so we will see. On January 10th, 2006, Paula Gallant's autopsy revealed that the cause of death was asphyxiation, with the method of death being strangulation. Paula was found to have no defensive wounds, but had distinct marks on her neck, petechial hemorrhaging of both her eyes, and a large contusion on the back of her skull. So for those who don't know what petechial hemorrhaging is, it's essentially where you have these sort of spots of bleeding on your eyeball.
From just like the pressure?
I would assume so.
Inside your head or something?
Yeah, so when you're being strangled and you can't breathe, your eyes just start to bleed and the vessels burst.
Mm-hmm. And how long from the time she went missing to the time they found her in her car? How many days was that?
Oh, it wasn't days. It was just hours.
Oh, okay.
So Jason said that she left to go shopping at 2 p.m. and they ended up discovering her car with her in the trunk at 12:30 a.m. Gotcha. Like the next day, but hours later. As with all cases, the spouse of a murdered individual is brought in for questioning right away. Jason McCrae completed an interview with police the day after Paula Gallant was found deceased in her trunk. He was interviewed a second and third time, January 11th and 30th, 2006. Following a fourth interview on February 8th, 2006, Jason was actually arrested and interviewed under caution. However, during each of these interrogations, he adamantly denied having anything to do with her murder.
So they interviewed him three times, and then the fourth time he was arrested and interviewed under caution. What does that mean?
So it essentially means that somewhere along the way, they think he may have done it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that be that there's evidence, whether it be a hunch, I would assume that there wasn't enough to arrest him and keep him.
Mm-hmm.
So it essentially means we're going to talk to you and give you the opportunity to explain what happened and if you had anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why when he said he didn't, he was released.
I wonder how consistent those four interrogations were, or if his story had been changing and that's why they were kind of like raising suspicions about him.
I think, based on what I've read, that his story stayed the exact same.
Okay.
Except for one story that I'll talk about in a second.
Okay.
During each interrogation, Jason told investigators that he didn't know what happened to Paula and that she left the house at 2 p.m. on December 27th to run some errands and she didn't return. So this is the story that did not change.
Okay.
Throughout the investigation, officers found no indication of any history of domestic violence, and friends and family who knew the couple said that Paula and Jason were in a happy and loving marriage. The only topic that did come up, which he initially lied about but later confessed, was a $700 online gambling debt that he had accumulated, and he told investigators that he had lied to Paula and told her that it was his brother's debt. During this interview where he told police, after he told them that he had lied to Paula, he said it was, quote, something I have to live with every day. I lied to Paula about something, end quote.
Red fucking flag.
Yeah. And also $700.
Okay, to be that heartbroken that you lied to your wife about a $700 gambling debt and just to take that to the bank, like, oh, I'm so sad and heartbroken that I lied to her, like,
trying a little too hard.
Right, yeah.
Following Paula Gallant's murder, her husband and daughter continued to live in their home, with Jason's mother moving in to lend a hand. The couple's mortgage was paid off through insurance, and Jason also received a one-time $2,500 death benefit and was also receiving CPP and NSTU benefits for himself and Anna, so through the government and through her work. Just days following his wife's murder, Jason attempted to make a claim on her $100,000 insurance policy, but the request was denied. Obviously, if it's an open murder investigation, they're not going to give them money right away before we know what happened.
Right.
As investigators looked into the circumstances surrounding her death, the murder of Paula Gallant could be found in the media nationally, with the National and the Fifth Estate covering her case. It was specifically one of the most high-profile unsolved murder cases in Nova Scotia, Canada at the time. Initially, parents of children at the school where Paula taught attended a meeting, searching for resources to help their children who had lost their teacher. The surrounding community was shocked and eager for answers, with little information being released other than that investigators believed that her murder was not random. But as time passed and her killer remained at large, Paula's sisters did everything they could to keep her name in the news, to spread awareness about her murder, and to push for people to come forward with information. 4 months following her murder, with no charges laid, Paula's sister Lynn spoke with the Globe and Mail, worried that the public had forgotten about Paula, saying, quote, "It's still very surreal and very unimaginable. A part of me has died forever." Lynn also said that herself, Lana, and Paula had always seen themselves as survivors, but with Paula gone, their grief made them numb. She said, quote, "I don't know what we are anymore. I wake up every day with one purpose, to be Paula's voice and see this to the end. There will be an ending to this story. I'm absolutely confident of that. I have to believe that," end quote.
For both of their parents to have died so tragically and so suddenly, and then their sister, now it's like this family of five has now been reduced to two. Like, where do you even go from there?
Yeah, and then, like they said, it's like they have to find hope and say, well, I'm just going to get up and fight for her to find who did this and put them away.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be the one thing keeping them going at that point. Paula's family and friends, as well as members of the community, also gathered at her gravestone, praying and hoping that Paula's killer would be found and put behind bars. Paula's husband, Jason, did not attend this memorial.
Why? What was his excuse for not being there?
There was one excuse given for a later thing that he misses, but for this one, don't know. Paula's sisters had also started a letter campaign to local newspapers in an attempt to spark memories surrounding her murder and to not let the public forget, due to the fact that it seemed as though the investigation was fading. This increased the media coverage, particularly through articles in the newspaper. Another meeting was held almost 9 months following Paula's murder, as the community grew more concerned about the unsolved homicide case and why there hadn't been any answers or information released. Community members expressed their wish to hear what was happening with the investigation. Within this meeting, though, police didn't comment on the investigation. But just 1 month later, Paula's sister Lynn spoke on the news about a $50,000 reward that was being offered for information regarding the murder of Paula Gallant, in hopes it would entice anyone to come forward if they knew anything. In 2006, almost 1 year after Paula's murder, a memorial was created for her at Beachville Lakeside Timberley School, where she taught. The memorial was named Paula's Place. It was an industrial arts room that was transformed to show off Paula's and students' artwork. The evening of its reveal, there were over 200 people in attendance. It took place on December 6th, the day of commemoration and action on violence against women, which is the anniversary of the massacre in Montreal where a perpetrator murdered 14 women. During the reveal, people shared stories of Paula Gallant, speaking to her character and her passion for art. Once again, Paula's husband Jason did not attend. In regards to the art room, Lana said, quote, "This just completely reflects who she was as a person. She saw the beauty in everything, and as tired and uninspiring as this room was prior to her death, she would have continued to allow the children to come in here and be inspired in the same manner," end quote. The principal of the school, Doug Pickup, said, quote, "What I leave here tonight with is that sense of how important each one of our lives is, and how important Paula Gallant's life was to this school, to you, to an area, and to a province. I honor that tonight," end quote. When Paula's sisters, Lana and Lynn, weren't actively in the news or newspapers fighting for their sister, they could be found walking around, knocking on doors in the neighborhood in hopes of finding information about what happened to her. Lynn said, quote, "Somebody murdered our sister. That's the biggest frustration. But also the fact that 12 months have passed and the monster responsible for the murder of our sister remains free." Paula's sisters also expressed their disappointment with the support they had received from the RCMP, saying, quote, "There have been many opportunities for us as sisters to stand in partnership with the RCMP and plea for the public support. We've never been granted that," end quote. At the time, police understood that the perpetrator either fled the scene via his own vehicle or that he left on foot. And as investigators attempted to gain more information about how Paula's car was parked in the school parking lot in broad daylight without witnesses, Lana and Lynn did another interview with the Globe and Mail. They pled with the public once again to keep an open mind, believing that someone must have seen something on the afternoon of December 27th that could help police solve the murder. Lana said, quote, "What people have to understand, we are normal, everyday people. This could happen to anybody's sister, friend, mother, or daughter," end quote. After this, there were some witnesses who came forward, with one person indicating that they were in the area of the school at 4 p.m. and the car wasn't there, and other witnesses claiming to have seen the car later that evening. This led investigators to believe that the car arrived in the school parking lot between 4 and 6:30 p.m. on December 27th. As the summer of 2007 rolled around with no updates or arrests, family and friends organized an annual memorial walk in Paula's community of Timberley called A Walk to Remember. The sisters also vocalized to the public regarding ending violence against women, hoping to improve victims' rights and experiences in the province and increase their access to counseling resources. Around this time, Crime Stoppers released a small segment about Paula's murder.
Crime Stoppers need your help in solving one of the most difficult cases in recent memory, the murder of Nova Scotia schoolteacher Paula Gallant. The married 36-year-old mother of one was last seen on December 27, 2005, when she spent the afternoon shopping in the Halifax area. Her body was found the next day in the parking lot of Beachville Lakeside Timberley School in the trunk of a green 1997 Chevrolet Cavalier. There was no sign of a struggle, but police were quick to determine they are investigating a murder.
The medical examiner went through and did his autopsy, passed those results on to us, and with his results, we deemed it to be a homicide.
Investigators believe someone out there knows or saw something that could bring the person responsible to justice. If you have any information on this senseless crime, please call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. Calls are not taped or traced, and if your tip leads to an arrest, you'll qualify for a cash award from $50 to $2,000. Remember, at Crime Stoppers, we want your information, not your name.
On October 10th, 2007, almost 2 years after Paula's murder, The street on which Paula's sister Lana lived was renamed Paula Drive in her memory. Lynn and Lana also created decals for car bumpers in their sister's memory, which were the letter P. The letter was written in cursive in the distinct way that Paula would write it. So these are the bumper stickers that Kristen mentioned at the beginning of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
A website was also made in Paula's name, www.paulagallant.com. The theme of the website was Paula, Peace, and Perseverance, which was meant to provide resources and communicate information regarding her case. There was a launch held for the website, and to no surprise, Jason did not attend.
Like, why are you not attending your dead wife's memorial services?
I think the thing is here, too, it's like, whether or not you were involved, that looks shady as fuck.
Yeah. What was your thought process with making that decision there?
This website was active beyond her murder being solved, but it's not anymore, unfortunately.
Okay.
At this time, so late 2007, discussion of Paula's disappearance and murder could easily be found online. The community continued to wonder what had happened to Paula and what was going on with the investigation, with some speculating or outright accusing Paula's husband, Jason, making it a point to take note of the way he had acted following her death, because not only did it seem cold, but also out of character. So apparently there was a post made by a local blogger about Paula's death, and this was essentially the spot where everyone went to just post their opinions and just to gossip. This was in 2007, so it was really before, probably right before the internet really took off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people were using this blog and saying that Jason did it and that he was, you know, such a loving person and was always there for her. So the fact that he wasn't there for anything was really strange.
Mm-hmm.
There were some people defending him. So it was a mixed bag of basically where people came to share their thoughts.
Could you like find any posts from that website?
No, I couldn't.
Is it probably not active anymore?
Yeah, no. Despite not having spoken to the media since Paula's death, Jason McCrae completed an interview with the Chronicle Herald newspaper on the 2-year anniversary of his wife's murder. Within the interview, he said that he was taking it day by day and was heartbroken, calling Paula his best friend in his whole life. He said he would never do anything to hurt her. He didn't comment on his initial arrest and release, but he did comment that he had missed past events for Paula because he had organized his own, more private events to commemorate the life of his wife. So essentially he was saying that he and Anna would do things on their own on those days, apparently scheduled on the exact same days.
Yeah, that is just very, very odd to me. And it's like, why wouldn't you want her daughter to be part of something like her mother's memorial? Why are you depriving her of that, too? Like, it's just very, very weird and definitely extremely questionable and shady.
In addition to this, Jason McCrae commented on the falling out of his relationship with Paula's sisters, indicating that only a few months after Paula's death, her sisters attempted to apply for full custody of his daughter Anna and specifically asked that he have no access to his child, saying that he was an unfit parent. In response to this, Jason said that he understood that Lynn and Lana wanted to spend time with their niece, but they went about it the wrong way. So I think it's clear here that her sisters had an idea in their minds about who had done it. It seems that way anyway. Unless they just straight up thought he was a bad parent and it had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. I would think if I were, you know, if it was my sister who had been murdered like that and the husband is acting really, really weird and trying to, you know, keep the kid away from the family and away from all these memorials and stuff, it's like, what are you doing behind the scenes while she's in your care? Like, you're such a grief-stricken father. And then your intuition would tell you if something isn't right. And I feel like in a situation like that, it would be pretty blatantly obvious. Like, hey, we've known this guy for X amount of years and suddenly his character has done a complete 180. He's acting super weird. Like, this is very unusual behavior for somebody whose partner has just been found dead in a car. And we are extremely concerned for the safety and well-being of our niece. So I would probably be doing the same thing.
Yeah, and I think this too, on top of the fact that he had not let Anna see her aunts since it happened.
Mm-hmm. Like, why?
Which, what?
Why?
And they're used to seeing her almost every day, multiple times a week. I'd be livid.
There's no reason for that to be happening at all, unless you're trying to hide something and you want the least amount of communication with her family as possible, then there would be no need to try to keep her child away from them.
Jason also indicated that he didn't foresee his life returning to normalcy, saying it had been torn upside down and taken from him, and their daughter Anna was what kept him going. He also released a public statement saying, quote, "We live in a very close-knit community. Everyone says hi to everyone in the street, and there are always people on the streets in our neighborhood every day. I can't understand how something like this tragedy could have happened in the middle of the day and no one see anything. If someone knows something and is afraid to come forward, it's not too late. Any information, even the smallest detail, may lead to a break in the case. My little girl is growing up without her mother because we have a killer walking amongst us. I do not want this to happen to someone else. If anyone knows anything about this case, please contact the police or Crime Stoppers." End quote. Still, Paula's sisters didn't give up. 3 years following her death, Lynn Gallant Blackburn wrote the following piece in memory of her sister Paula. It's quite long, but I felt each section was important to read. Quote, December 25th, 2005. Christmas, like every Christmas since we were born, was spent together under one roof from the 24th to the 26th. As we raised our glasses during our Christmas meal to give thanks for all that we had, we could never have imagined that the acts of another human being 2 days later could bring such pain and devastation to this loving and happy family. On December 27th, 2005, just 1 week before her daughter Anna's first birthday, my 36-year-old sister, Paula Ann Gallant, was violently murdered. Her lifeless body was put in the trunk of her car, which was then driven to her elementary school just minutes from her home. Her car, with her dead body in the trunk, was later discovered by family. Life as we knew it was redefined in the most horrific and unimaginable manner possible. Someone living amongst us made a choice to end Paula's life, to end her career as a teacher and artist, to end her role as a mother, friend, sister, aunt, and so much more. Shock, disbelief, numbness, isolation, indescribable pain, confusion, fear, and inability to function. You keep hoping you're going to wake up and it will be the same as it was before the nightmare. Then you look into your children's eyes, into the eyes of those who have filled your home, and you know it is real. Sobs fill the silence. You pray that darkness will not fall. You don't want your friends to ever leave your kitchen because then you know you will be left alone to feel. It's like your body is consumed with concrete and you cannot move. You barely breathe. You know it's worse than you ever thought possible. Chaos exists, but not like the hectic chaos we all live daily. It is a solemn, subdued, eerie chaos. We all sit waiting, not knowing what to do or when to do it. The phone rings constantly and we just hope someone on the other end will help us. Over 3 years have passed since that horrible, senseless day Paula's voice was silenced through murder. As if the loss is not painful enough, we also continue to live without closure or justice for this violent crime. This is as agonizing as the crime itself. Knowing the person responsible is living freely among us. You're consumed with one thought. How are we going to survive this nightmare? In the first couple of weeks, the numbness and pain is crippling, but hope is prevalent. Hope that justice will come quickly so our efforts can be focused on healing. But as time passes, you are presented with the harsh realities of the situation. Once you're able to absorb this reality, the challenge becomes getting on with life and redefining normal without Paula. With an altered family structure and with the acceptance the killer lives freely in our society. It's the hardest thing I've ever been faced with in my life, and there's no handbook or blueprint to guide and provide the required support. You're exposed to the learnings of a life experience one should never have to endure, and you look to everyone for answers, for closure, for justice, for peace. The first half of the second year was a continuation of the first year. The pain was as raw, the frustration as exhausting, the need for answers as consuming. But just as the murderer had the free will to make the choice to silence Paula, I too realized at some point in year two that I had the free will to choose to either be a victim or be a survivor. In choosing to survive, I could not only be Paula's voice, but the voice for all women who have lost their lives to violence or continue to be victims of violence. I also realized I had the opportunity, through my experience, to become an advocate for all victims of murder in the hopes of improving the levels of support and types of services provided. It was a turning point for me in this journey, and although I knew it would be a daunting undertaking, I felt it would give meaning to Paula's death. Trying to drive change is not easy. I hit one roadblock after another and felt even more isolated as I came to realize my voice as a victim of murder was weak. It would be so easy to just walk away. But through the love, support, and encouragement of my family, friends, our communities, the media, and so many others, I knew this would become my lifelong purpose. In 2008, when I was preparing information for an event called Men Standing Up Against Violence Against Women during Family Violence Prevention Week, I came across the following quote, which is now my guiding principle. I'm only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something that I can do. By Edward Everett Hale. The letter continues. I cannot refuse to do the something I can do. I have experience as my foundation, Paula as my strength, society as my support, and my free will to choose to survive and make a positive contribution. I guess one could say I have evolved through this nightmare and now have the clarity, confidence, and steadfast determination to be a strong voice for Paula, for all who have lost their lives to violence, and to the victims of murder who represent the minority. I cannot change what happened to Paula, nor can I bring her back. I cannot make the last 3 years any easier or wave a magic wand and get the justice Paula deserves, but I can try and drive change. Change that gives victims the required support to get through the maze with expert guidance, empathy, dignity, respect, and most importantly, the ability to one day heal. Change that makes society more aware and less tolerant of violence. It should not be an acceptable norm. And so as I drove from Paula's grave on Christmas Day 2008, filled with sorrow, I realized how far I had come and I knew I would survive and be the voice society would someday embrace. End quote.
Wow, that's so devastating and very beautifully written. And I just feel like that letter just gave me such a deep understanding of what she felt during that period of time. And she's absolutely right by saying that nobody should ever, ever, ever have to experience that and feel alone and have nobody to turn to, because who the hell goes through something like this? Like, it's absolutely awful. But the fact that she was able to somehow, some way turn around and use it to her advantage to help other women is incredible.
Oh, it's so admirable.
And I just can't imagine, because it would be so easy. And I feel like most people in this situation, it would be so easy for them just to curl up in a hole.
Mm-hmm. And not to say that that's wrong.
No, it's not wrong. That's how,
however.
Right. That's, you know, that's how a lot of people cope. So the fact that she was able to be like, no, I'm not going to let this hold me down, and I have to do something that's going to make me feel better at the end of the day, mm-hmm. takes a lot of strength and a lot of bravery.
Mm-hmm.
And
to do it not only for her sister, but for other women,
yeah.
and to try to prevent this from happening to others.
Yeah.
It's super selfless and mm-hmm. really, really amazing.
And I mean, what better person to speak to women of domestic violence and somebody who's experienced it in such a horrific and personal manner.
At the end of 2008, Lynn and Lana fought for the reward regarding information in Paula's case to be continued and increased, and at the end of the year, it rose to $150,000. The family hoped that this larger reward might entice someone further to come forward. On December 5th, 2008, Family, friends, community members, politicians, and members of the RCMP gathered at BLT school to celebrate what would have been Paula's 39th birthday. Paula's sisters were praised for their efforts to keep their sister's case in the media, as well as for their efforts to raise awareness of violence against women. At this same event, a children's book was revealed, written in Paula's memory, called Miss Gallant's Favorite Season, written by Louise Christie. The story is based on Miss Gallant, who is Paula, speaking to her students in her classroom about her favorite season and having them celebrate the season with art. Copies of the book were distributed to every school library in the province of Nova Scotia. All of the proceeds from the sale of the book went to local organizations trying to end violence against women. The event concluded with cake, a walk, and a candlelight vigil. Shocker, Jason McRae did not make an appearance.
Shaking my head.
Another year passed, and in 2009, it seemed there were still no developments in the case. At this time, Jason McRae spoke with the Fifth Estate and said, quote, "Maybe something done nationally might create more awareness and actually bring something to light," end quote. Jason also spoke publicly to bring awareness to Paula's murder on the National. I couldn't find either of these, but I'm assuming they were taken down. While many believe that the investigation into the murder of Paula Gallant had been at a standstill, investigators were working hard behind the scenes in an attempt to gather enough evidence to put away the person they believe was responsible from the moment the investigation had begun, Paula Gallant's husband, Jason McRae. Although police were not able to gather enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Jason McRae had killed his wife, they had begun an undercover operation to get him to confess. A Mr. Big sting. Mr. Big operations were developed by the RCMP in Canada and are actually prohibited in the United States. Within these investigations, undercover officers essentially fabricate a fictitious criminal gang with investigators posing as members of this gang or syndicate. Initially, an undercover officer will bump into the suspect as a stranger and will likely ask them to complete a small task or favor. The officer will slowly befriend the suspect and offer more small jobs or tasks, eventually indicating that they are part of a criminal gang. They'll then invite the suspected criminal to join their group and become involved with the exchanges and work within the gang. The suspects are given odd jobs within the gang, such as money counters, lookouts for staged crimes, such as robberies and assaults, as well as drug exchanges. The suspect, who believes they are a member of the gang, is compensated for the work they do and is able to move up in the ranks within the gang. Then there is the crime boss, who's often referred to as the Mr. Big character, which is where the name comes from. Eventually, Mr. Big indicates to the suspect that they are able to help them avoid being put away for a crime or make it evaporate into thin air, as long as they know all of the details and exactly how it happened. So they essentially indicate to the person, you know, we heard somewhere along the line that you were a suspect for this murder and we just need the details. You need to tell us exactly what happened and we can erase it for you. Thinking about this, and especially thinking about how long this one lasted and how many people were involved, I just think it's so amazing how intricate these operations are. Every single person, except the one suspected criminal, are undercover officers.
Right.
They live in this fake crime world where they're working, exchanging money, faking robberies, even faking murders. It's insane.
Yeah, it's like a little society.
And to do this for months and months and months, and just to hold this facade of being a gang member, that would be unbelievable.
It's pretty incredible. So this Mr. Big operation where you're saying that, you know, they're trying to get all this information from the perpetrator and then saying, you know, oh, we can help erase this crime for you or make it evaporate into thin air. How do they go about doing something like that?
So I think essentially parts of it would be walk us through what happened and we can dispose of any evidence. We can think about anything you might have missed to get rid of it. And I think another part of it would be like we know people who we can pay off to make this go away. It's sort of like if you're going to be a part of our gang, which at that point, they're truly in it and they think that they are a gangster.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think of what we see in the movies like gang initiations where you might have to kill somebody or blah, blah, blah. And they say like, hey, you got your hands dirty here. We need you to just tell us what happened so that we can go through each step and make it so that you don't get convicted of this.
Mm-hmm.
A professor of psychology at St. Mary's University in Halifax named Stephen Smith discussed the Mr. Big technique in an article for CBC News. Criminals involved in the operations usually find themselves in a spot where they're holding on to a secret and are desperate to be free of it. Dr. Smith said he believed that many people wonder how the criminals fall for the tactic. He said, quote, "You have to remember the context that these people are in. They are desperate and they want to believe that they have a friend, and this gives them that opportunity. Not only a friend, but often a way out. They know they've been a suspect for years and they're being told, look, all you need to do is tell us what happened and we can get rid of this evidence for you." End quote. Allegedly, approximately 95% of suspected criminals who are brought into a Mr. Big operation admit to and provide the details of the crime, with the majority of them going on to be convicted of said crime. Dr. Smith said, quote, "It's not a big step to go from confessing to the crime to reenacting, because once you're over that hump of actually confessing, it's a really small step to reenact," end quote. Mr. Big operations tend to be used as a last resort when there is insufficient evidence to support investigators' suspicions of a suspect or perpetrator. Although the technique is known to have been effective in hundreds of cold cases across Canada, the technique is highly controversial due to the fact that the potential perpetrators could be put into a position where they may be compelled to lie in order to show off, to seem legitimate in their gang, to stay in the gang, or even because they feel they may be hurt if they don't confess. Stephen Smith also compared Mr. Big Stings to routine police interrogations, speaking specifically of false confessions. He pointed out that within interrogations, there is a large number of suspects who confess despite the fact that they are innocent. Therefore, with the added pressure of a criminal gang used in the Mr. Big operation, there would likely be an even higher chance of false confession. Smith highlighted that because of this, there needs to be a substantial amount of physical evidence that supports the purported crime. In other words, there needs to be tangible proof that corroborates the crime to rule out the possibility that the suspect is not simply making up a story because they are a gang member. Due to controversy around the technique, in 2014, the Supreme Court of Canada modified the admissibility of evidence and confessions provided through Mr. Big operations. The Supreme Court created a framework that meant to ensure reliability and protect suspects from abuse and manipulation. Those involved in Mr. Big Stings will usually quickly point out that the operation is meant to uncover the truth rather than to elicit a confession. So in 2014, they essentially said, we can't just take the confession alone. There needs to be other things that prove that this happened. There needs to be evidence that corroborates the story that the person is giving. In October of 2009, almost 4 years after Paula Gallant was murdered, Jason McCrae was approached by an undercover officer who was part of a Mr. Big operation. The gang, which was actually a group of undercover officers, worked to build Jason's trust. 6 months into the undercover investigation, Jason had already quit his job at Nova Scotia Power and was working full-time for the fabricated syndicate. Then, another 4 months later, Jason was approached by a fellow gang member who indicated that they'd come across police information about his suspected involvement in his wife's murder. Jason was told that in order to make this issue go away, he needed to confess and provide all of the details. After months and months of undercover work, Jason McCrae confessed to an undercover officer in August of 2010. He provided the crime boss with all of the details of how he killed his own wife, and he told the boss this in a hotel in Newfoundland. 3 days later, he then reenacted the crime for the Mr. Big officer at his home in Tantallon, believing that the gang would be able to make all the evidence disappear. Jason's confession was recorded without his knowledge, wherein he told the undercover officer that he had pondered murdering his wife for a while, but he didn't believe he would actually follow through with it. He said, quote, "Honestly, I had thought about it before, but I didn't think I would ever do it. It just happened. Then yeah, I pretty much knew I was gonna do it when I did it, end quote.
What do you mean it just happened?
Jason also indicated that he and Paula had gotten into an argument about the $700 gambling debt that he had accrued. He said that between 2 and 2:30, he walked away from his wife, grabbed a 2x4 and returned to where she was sitting at the computer, and he swung at her. On his first swing, he missed Paula and hit the wall near her head. He then swung again, this time striking her in the back of the head. During the reenactment, Jason is able to show the area of the wall that he accidentally hit with the 2x4 in his initial attempt to strike her, pointing out that he had repaired the hole in the wall in the days following the murder. This repaired area where Jason had patched up was noticeable. The blow didn't knock Paula unconscious. Instead, she stood up and turned around, screaming. He grabbed her around the neck and pushed her into the laundry room. Despite her pleading with him to stop, he strangled her for a couple of minutes on the floor in the laundry room, saying it was a, quote, big fight. It got out of control. He also indicated that her pants were wet and he thought she may have peed herself.
That's so just,
demoralizing, yeah, and sad.
Yeah.
After he had strangled her, he said he wrapped cling wrap around her head and face 3 or 4 times to ensure that she had stopped breathing, leaving it there for roughly 20 minutes.
Like, you are a fucking monster.
He also indicated that her last words were, "What are you doing? Stop."
That's just so horrific. I like have no words for that. How you can do that to the mother of your child, your wife, your partner in such a callous way.
Mm-hmm. And you got into an argument over a $700 debt.
Yeah, like for what? What made this escalate to that extent? Like, what was even the motive there? Like, did he just completely fly off the handle into a blind rage and, like, didn't realize what he was doing at the time until it was too late? But then if he's sitting there saying that, oh, yeah, like, I had thought about killing her before.
We'll go on to see, and I don't think that it was, like, a crime of passion where he lost his mind. I think he had been thinking, when am I going to do it? In that moment, he said, now's the time.
I can't wrap my mind around how these people's brains work. Like, at what point in your life did you come to the conclusion that you want to murder somebody?
And that's the way out. You're having little arguments with your wife and you think the best course of action is to murder her.
Right.
Jason also indicated that as he murdered his wife, he heard their infant daughter Anna waking up from her afternoon nap. So he threw a sheet over Paula's body, leaving her on the basement floor, and went upstairs to feed Anna. Then he left the 11-month-old in her high chair while he went to dispose of Paula's body between 3 and 4 p.m.
That makes me sick.
So, so disgusting. It just further goes to show what kind of person he is.
Ugh.
He first checked outside to see if anyone was around before returning downstairs. He dressed Paula in the windbreaker and he placed shoes on her feet. He indicated that he wrapped her in the sheet and pushed her through a window, which was level with the driveway, and Paula's car had been backed into it. He put her body in the trunk of her car, covering her with an emergency blanket that he had found in the first aid kit in her trunk. Upon noticing that one of her shoes had fallen off, he took off the remaining shoe and placed them both near her head in the trunk. So here's a photo of the window and the driveway where he pushed her body through, just so you can get a visual of her car was backed up right there and he just slid her body out.
And this is their home?
That's it, yep.
Wow.
Then Jason drove Paula's car with her body in the trunk to her place of work, BLT School, parking it in the parking lot. He left her keys and purse in the console and headed home on foot. On the way home, he stopped at the neighborhood mailbox to make it seem like he was fetching the mail in case he was spotted by someone in the area. At 4 p.m., he then places his daughter Anna in his vehicle and drives to dispose of the 2x4 and the cling wrap, throwing them in a dumpster near the Halifax Shopping Center. On the way home, he stopped at the bank and deposited $100 and also stopped at the corner store to buy batteries in an attempt to create an alibi. The following day, Jason found one of Paula's earrings on the floor of the laundry room and took it to a nearby Tim Hortons a few days later, disposing of it in a garbage can. He also happened to notice a small cut on his hand when he returned home that day and indicated that he had checked Paula's nails at the funeral and noticed that they had been clipped. Just so disgusting. You're checking your wife's nails.
Probably because he knows, like, shit, they probably have my DNA under her nails.
Mm-hmm. At her service.
Priorities.
The following are some quotes from Jason McCrae's interactions with the undercover officers during his confession. Some quotes and conversations have been cut for brevity. I will play Jason and Kristen will play the undercover officer. I had had thoughts about it, but I didn't think I would ever do it, but...
How long before that did you last have thoughts that you were gonna whack her?
Oh, it was, a couple of days before that, probably.
But you were thinking, like, doing it that way, or...?
I'm trying to think. I thought of it. I actually thought to myself, how could I do this if I actually did do it? Yeah, like, I had thought about, like, do I wake up in the morning one day and just grab her, or in bed? And then I had some different ideas, and then that day it just...
So what, your ideas? Well, was it, like, what you did? Or hit her? Or choke her? Or shoot her?
To choke her. That was my idea. To choke her. So at this point, Jason's looking at a picture of Paula. Honestly, when I look at this, I usually think, like, fuck, one day we were happy. Like, we were really happy at one time. She was, nothing could be out of fucking, forget to take something downstairs as soon as I finish with it. She'd get on my case. She really needed to be perfect.
A lot of women are that way, though, anyway. Like, when you were thinking about it, I mean, did you know that this is not gonna last? One day she's fucking dead, or...
I had. Honestly, yeah, I think I did.
You did what?
I pretty much decided that this was gonna have to be done.
When did you think you were gonna do it, if you knew you were gonna whack her?
I think, like I say, it was probably only a couple of weeks, maybe a month, that I actually started having ideas of it, of doing it.
Yeah, but you knew that that was gonna happen, you just didn't know when, or...
I had pretty much decided, yeah, it was gonna happen, but I don't know if I actually knew that I would go through with it. I mean, it was one day I was like, fuck yeah, I'm gonna fucking do this. And then the next day, no, I can't do that.
But that morning, okay, she bitches at you for whatever. Money, money. When you get up that morning, did you know you were gonna whack her, or...?
No. In fact, like, when we got up that morning, she went out. She went to the hardware store to get some stuff, and then she came back. And then, like I say, she wasn't in the door 5 minutes, and she was just bitching at me about something. And, like, I think something just went off, and I said, okay, apparently today is the day. At this point, they're both laughing.
So did you say, okay, today's the day, and then you just happened to see the wood? Or you saw the wood and you said, okay, now this is it?
I saw the wood and said, yeah, this is it.
Okay, and then you guys had this argument and you choke her. You guys weren't getting along, or what?
I mean, we were getting along fine. It was little things, little petty things. Like, we'd have little arguments, but nothing too major. But then she had just found out that I had just lost a bit of money gambling.
So she probably wasn't too happy about that.
No, she wasn't happy about that.
How did she find out about that?
I actually ended up telling her. I lied to her about it at first and told her that I lent my brother the money.
Oh, because this was money out of your bank account?
Yeah, and then she just kept asking me. At one point, Jason told the undercover officer, quote, "You realize I loved her. I really did." Following his confession, a search warrant was carried out, wherein investigators located the repaired drywall that corroborated Jason's story of swinging the 2x4 towards Paula and missing. It was also located at the height of the computer chair. 1 week after he confessed during the Mr. Big operation on August 17th, 2010, Jason McCrae was arrested at the home he once shared with his wife in Timberley, almost 5 years after her murder. The public was made aware that an arrest was made in the case, but the identity of the suspect was not released. The following day, though, Jason McCrae's name was released, and he attended a court hearing. Jason was charged with the first-degree murder of his wife, Paula Gallant. So here's a photo of him walking into court.
Looks like one sad, miserable prick.
Definitely looks like a prick. Shortly after Jason's arrest, investigators were seen leaving the former Gallant McCrae residence with a piece of drywall. At the time, the investigation was still underway, so the public was not informed about the Mr. Big operation. Instead, police told the public that the investigation, which involved the RCMP and the Halifax Regional Police, had been, quote, very intensive and extensive, involving a lot of dedicated members that kept working at this file. The police chief also indicated that, quote, new evidence came to light which allowed us to pursue it in a different way. When he was asked why it took so long to charge Jason McCrae, he said, quote, you have to do the investigation. The new information wasn't going to put somebody before the court, so we had to build an investigative approach to get the necessary information to put the person before the court. The family's spokesperson, a family friend named Ted McGinnis, read a statement at the time Jason McCrae was charged, saying, quote, to family, friends, community members, and the media, no words can fully express their deepest gratitude for the ongoing support they received through this entire ordeal. It has been greatly appreciated, and the strength, hope, and prayers that have been extended since December 27, 2005 will never be forgotten. As we think of Paula today, Anna, Paula's daughter, is especially in our hearts and prayers. The family would also like to extend their prayers to the McCrae family. The family realizes this is the beginning of a legal process and asks that their privacy be respected, end quote. So this is a photo of the man, Ted, reading the statement, and you can just see all of the microphones around his face as he reads it. Paula Gallant's daughter, Anna, who had been living with her father since her mother was murdered, was at the time 5 years old. Upon Jason's arrest, police went to work to find living arrangements for Anna. Daryl Beaton with the RCMP said, quote, obviously we're very much aware that the child is a factor in this investigation and what is going to occur, and that has been addressed. The investigative team has a family liaison that is working through those issues and that has been fully addressed. We have no concerns about the well-being and the welfare of the child, end quote. Less than 2 months after he was charged, Jason made an attempt to apply for bail, but the application was eventually withdrawn. After waiving his right to a preliminary trial, Jason McCrae, who was originally charged with first-degree murder, was meant to make an appearance in court to set a date for a trial. However, in March of 2011, he took a plea deal, pleading guilty to second-degree murder, so the court then moved on to victim impact statements and sentencing. Jason McCrae's deal involved second-degree murder rather than first due to a lack of evidence. The Crown prosecutor indicated, quote, ultimately, we felt that the evidence of planning and deliberation here was not sufficient to sustain a conviction for first-degree murder, end quote. Which I feel, unfortunately, does make sense because even in just the quotes that we read, he sort of goes back and forth between how long it was that he thought about it and what he didn't think about it that day, but then suddenly he thought about it. So There wasn't anything that was super clear to indicate that he was planning to kill her. On Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011, Paula Gallant's sisters, family, and friends attended Jason McCrae's hearing at the Nova Scotia Supreme Court. The statement of facts, which are publicly available, were presented to the courtroom by the prosecution. Within the statement of facts were the events leading up to Paula being reported missing, the discovery of her body, as well as the details of the undercover Mr. Big operation, which included Jason McCrae's incriminating conversations with the undercover officers as he described how he had killed his own wife. Following this, there were 10 victim impact statements read, which included Paula's brother-in-law, Alan Blackburn, and her sister, Lynn Blackburn. Paula's brother-in-law, Alan, who identified Paula's body, said, quote, how did I get stuck with this cowardly, selfish monster? I will always see Paula's face in the trunk of the car, end quote. Paula's sister, Lynn, spoke of how their family questioned Jason's emotionless response to his wife's death at her funeral, indicating that he seemed hesitant to go near her casket at her service. She said, quote, he had all the answers and could have ended the suffering, but instead he moved on without any regard for anyone but himself. I have to live every day without my sweet baby sister in my life, end quote. Following the hearing, Jason McCrae stood in the courtroom making the following statement. Quote, I want to say I'm sorry. I've never been a violent person. I don't know what changed in me that day. I wish it didn't happen, but it did. In spite of what happened, I loved her very much. A beautiful person's life was lost that day, and I'm truly sorry for all the pain I have caused. End quote. Jason allegedly showed no emotion while making this statement.
Of course he didn't. And the fact that he continuously brings up the fact like, oh, you know, I really did love her, though. Like, how can you say that? That, like, just, you obviously did not love her. I'm not sure what your idea of love is, but you don't do this to somebody that you love. So maybe let's not try to reiterate how much you loved your wife. Thank you very much.
And just the wording of it, like, it's just a slap in the face.
Yeah.
If you kill someone I love and then you say you love them and mm-hmm. you say their life was, quote, lost. No, it was not lost. It was stolen mm-hmm. by you
mm-hmm.
who acted on an impulse. And no, you did not love her. And to say that in front of a group of people who really do love her is a punch in the gut.
Totally.
The sentence for second-degree murder in Canada is life in prison with no possibility for parole for 10 years. However, the Crown disputed that Jason McRae should serve 20 years before being eligible to apply for parole, whereas the defense argued that Jason served 12 years before being eligible to apply for parole. Just before sentencing Jason McRae, the judge, Kevin Cody, said that Jason does, quote, lack to some degree a conscience. The reality is he is a very dangerous person. The potential for violence is real. Miss Gallant did nothing to bring this violence upon herself. He just decided to do it, more or less to settle an argument. It is he who has failed, end quote. Ultimately, Jason McRae was sentenced to life in prison with no eligibility for parole for 15 years.
So what would that bring the year to then, his eligibility for parole?
So roughly March 2011, 15 years from then would be 2026, which is coming up soon.
Mm.
Following the hearing, Jason's defense lawyer, Michael Taylor, said, quote, the real Jason McRae was not known by friends and family members. The fact that he was prepared to join what he thought was a life of crime spoke to his character, end quote. He also indicated that he was content with the judge's decision, saying, quote, we always deal in ranges. There's no specific number. It's in the range, and I think in this case it's appropriate, end quote. The Crown prosecutor, Denise Smith, was disappointed with the judge's decision. Just outside the courtroom, Paula's sister, Lynn, on behalf of Paula's family, spoke to the media, saying, quote, through this long journey, there have been times when we were not certain this day would come. It is due to the perseverance of many dedicated professionals, as well as the strong support of the community and the media that has led to prosecution. It is our hope that today's decision will begin to bring some peace to our families, friends in the community, and we can start to move forward with Paula in our hearts, end quote. Paula Gallant's daughter Anna has since lived with and been raised by her sister and brother-in-law Lana and Paul Kenny. Even after Paula Gallant's murderer was convicted, her sisters continued on fighting in her name and memory. Paula's sister Lana was recognized by the Nova Scotia legislature, receiving a Democracy 250 award for all of the work she put in with the media and public to spread awareness of violence against women in her sister's honor. Paula's sisters indicated that they want her to be remembered for the life that she lived prior to her death, not for the way she was murdered or where her body was found. In 2016, Lynn spoke for the Shine the Light on Women Abuse campaign and also participated in a video alongside the Prime Minister, shedding light on the women and girls who are hurt and killed by their partners. Within the video, Lynn spoke of Paula, her kindness, thoughtfulness, sensitivity, and creativity. A memorial fund was created for Paula, and money from this fund was donated to the Transition House Association of Nova Scotia, an organization which works to, quote, address barriers that prevent women and their children from living free of violence and abuse. Through this organization, an annual project was created in Paula's name called the Paula Gallant Modified Art Therapy Project. This project is specifically for survivors of violence and abuse, and roughly 300 women take part each year. Some of the past projects included, quote, putting a face on abuse, where survivors created masks that represented themselves or the abuse they experience, quote, transformation through layers, a collage project where survivors reflect upon where they came from, where they are currently and where they want to be, and quote, windows to our world, women's reasons for refuge, where survivors visually represent how they created safe spaces for themselves and their families. Myrna Dawson, who works in the sociology and anthropology department at the University of Guelph, discussed violence against women and its prevalence around the world, saying, quote, "There's a general perception, I think, in the general public that these are crimes of passion, that they can't be predicted, etc. So I think the message I'm bringing is that it can be prevented and the community can play a role in that," end quote. Silent Witness Nova Scotia, an organization to help prevent and raise awareness of domestic violence in Nova Scotia, revealed four red silhouettes in memory of four women who were murdered by their partner, and Paula Gallant was one of the women represented by a silhouette. These were brought around Nova Scotia to raise awareness about violence against women, to provide a physical reminder of the real women who lost their lives at the hands of their partners. Between 1990 and 2018, there were 62 women in Nova Scotia who lost their lives to violence at the hands of their partners. And according to the Canadian Women's Foundation, every 6 days, a woman in Canada is killed by her partner, with the prevalence increasing around the COVID-19 pandemic. Dolly Mosier, the co-founder of Silent Witness, said, quote, "When things like this happen in small communities, everybody kind of goes back to their house and shuts the door and doesn't want to talk about it. What we want is communities to go to their policing agencies and say, there's domestic violence here. How can we partner with you to get programs in our communities?" End quote. Paula's sister Lynn said, quote, "You hope to create awareness that she was like the neighbor next door. She was your child's school teacher. She could be your child's aunt." End quote. In 2020, a bench was placed by Silent Witness Nova Scotia on the St. Margaret's Bay Trail to commemorate the life of Paula Gallant. This purple bench has a plaque which has emergency contact information for those experiencing domestic violence. Paula's sister has released the following statement. "December 27th marks the 15th year of our beautiful sister Paula's death. Since that time, our family has continued to raise awareness about violence against women. In our efforts to continue to raise awareness, our family worked with Silent Witness Nova Scotia and the St. Margaret's Bay Rails to Trails Association on the placement and dedication of a vivid purple bench on the trail in Paula's memory. Purple is a symbol of courage, survival, and honor, and has come to symbolize the fight to end violence against women." End quote. In Halifax, decals of Paula's curved P can still be seen on vehicles today, which just goes to show how many lives Paula touched while she was here.
It's just such a heartbreaking story.
And when it happens so close to home, and the fact that it went so long being unsolved is another scary aspect. Obviously very grateful that they worked really hard to put him away, but it's just scary to think of what a person can get away with.
Yeah.
Especially somebody who just decided on a whim to kill his wife. He didn't plan it, you know, and wasn't being careful with DNA and hiding stuff. It was very abrupt in his decision. I mean, obviously it was 2005, so a little bit different than today, but it's just heartbreaking that her sister spent all of those years just fighting for her and how much time and effort it took to get him behind bars.
Yeah. And like for him to kill her, put her in the trunk, and then drop the car off behind the school that she works at.
In the middle of the day.
Like, of all the places that you could have taken her, that was your choice? And then to play the part of the concerned husband, here, let me look up her bank statements, and we'll see where she's at, and, you know, let me go run around to all these stores that she's been shopping at today, and help in the search, and this and that, and all of the extensive effort that he's putting in to this facade.
And only in the initial hours, because after that it was like, meh.
Yeah, he's just gonna drop off the face of the earth and now suddenly like just stop showing up for things. Like,
I just picture him driving to Costco and just like doing a loop. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, did he even go to Costco, or did he just pull up the street and wait there for a certain amount of time and drive back?
Oh, he's probably thinking the entire drive, like, fuck, I need to convince her family that I have no idea what the hell is going on right now. And even bringing her family to the school and to the car, knowing she's in the fucking trunk.
Yep.
Like, the audacity.
Yeah, I believe he said that he knew that she had been working on a project and thought it would be a good place to check.
I just have no words for that. And the fact that it took so long to get him arrested, you know, that's agonizing for the family to go every day thinking that nothing is happening. And, you know, they lost hope. They just came to the realization that the killer is still living among us and we need to make peace with the fact that we are never going to find out who did this to our sister.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably thought he got off scot-free.
Yeah.
So to see the look on his face when the police are arresting him for the murder of his wife, what was it, 5 years later?
Yep, 5 years later.
He must have been so fucking shocked and shook to his core.
That he had gotten away with it for so long.
Yeah.
And he was put behind bars because he deadass thought that he was a gang member and was so cool with all his other gang members and told them what he did. And then within a few days, they were like, gotcha, buddy.
Yeah.
It really is like that quote where it said people question why they do this. And really, in my head, I'm like, how are you that stupid? Especially in Canada where you know that this happens. But it's so true. Like, they're holding the secret. It's driving them crazy.
Mm-hmm.
To go 10 months in what you believe is a gang, probably at that point you're like, okay, well, this has to be real. This is way too long.
Yeah.
It's like, that is so elaborate.
Mm-hmm.
All of those members of the RCMP who were involved in that were just, hey, honey, like, I'm going to work now. I'm Tony in a gang. Like, what? It's so crazy to me.
They all need, like, acting awards or something.
Literally.
Like, that's crazy.
I feel like you would start to adopt the persona. Like, it would be really hard to separate, I feel.
Yeah.
Like, you get home and to your wife, you're like, you're a fucking... my bad. I was in actor mode.
Just go to church on Sunday and then turn around Monday and, like, you're just a gangbanger all of a sudden.
And it's like, what if somebody sees you out somewhere and, like, the staging of murders? Like, they stage fake murders.
I don't even know how they do that, but...
And so much of it is just kept under wraps because I feel like a lot of it is so messed up.
Oh,
but
yeah.
In my opinion, if it puts people behind bars who would have otherwise been free, have at it.
Yeah, totally.
It's pretty crazy some of the stories that have, you know, come to conclusion because of this.
Mm-hmm.
Those two boys out west, that one of them it was his parents, you know the story. It's like one of the most famous Mr. Big cases. We'll have to cover it. Yeah, so that's Atif Rafay, who was sentenced for killing his parents. And it was him and his friend. And essentially his parents had been bludgeoned to death. And he did it with his friend Sebastian. There's actual tapes of him confessing too. That's a really, really famous Mr. Big case.
And he was a teenager?
Yeah, they were both teenagers.
Jesus. Yeah, I remember listening to, I think it was Canadian True Crime. I think you sent me that episode actually on... Krista and Karen Hart from Newfoundland. They were two little twin toddler girls.
Yes.
Who were murdered by their father, who essentially just like took them down to a lake and like kicked them off a raft and let them drown and just turned around and walked away and pretended like he had no idea what happened to his kids.
Right.
And yeah, he got nailed with a Mr. Big operation as well.
He did. And that's another thing, like that case in particular. Like, when you have a case with a parent who was somewhere with his kids and they drown, how could you ever prove with evidence what happened?
Mm.
It's like, it seems impossible. Yeah. So, in that case, it's like, thank goodness that things like this exist.
I know. Yeah. I would never even think to do something like this as a possibility. Like, where do they make, like, where do the police come up to these conclusions? Like, oh, let's just create this entire little fake society and recruit this perpetrator who we think is guilty to try to elicit a confession. And we don't care if it takes months and years. Like, we'll go on and on with this until we get what we need.
Yeah, I think, honestly, it's when they are backed into a corner and they essentially say, we're fairly certain that this is who did it and all signs point to this person, but we don't have a lick of evidence and we want to just put them in a position where we can figure out, did they do it or did they not? And there are plenty of cases where people will say, like, no, I didn't do it. And like anything, there has been, you know, controversy. And that's why in 2014, the laws were changed where there has to be some sort of supporting evidence along with it and not just a story.
Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that, you know, Mr. Big operations are a thing and that there are dedicated officers who are willing to commit to something like that, because they obviously know, like, you know, we're not going to get a confession out of this guy in a couple days or a couple weeks. Like, we're signing up for this for the long run. And hopefully all of the officers who partake in Mr. Big operations are, you know, as committed to it as the ones in this one were.
Yeah.
Because the whole goal here is, you know, let's do this until we get what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of just being like, oh, you know, it's been a year and he's not saying anything, so I guess we're just going to give up. Like, you know, at least they tried and they knew that something wasn't right and they knew that he was guilty, and they just ended up saying the right things and making him trust them and kept on going with this game that they were playing.
Yep.
Until he just drops his big secret.
Yeah, they're essentially just over that period of time gaining trust with him and making it seem real. Bad news. I just read that Nelson Hart was released.
Who's that?
On appeal.
Is that the father?
Yeah. This must be one of the cases that led to them making that rule, because he was released from custody.
Wow.
That's crazy. So we actually also have a follower who is choosing to remain anonymous, who knew Jason McRae when they were younger. And so I'm just going to read what they sent about their experience with him, because I feel like it's always really interesting to think about the fact that this guy one day killed somebody and he lived his whole life up until that moment. And what was he like?
Mm-hmm.
So this follower of ours was friends with him. So they said, quote, "So I met Jay, being Jason, when I was 17, just at the end of high school. He sort of just showed up out of nowhere and joined our friend group, and we became fast friends. We spent the next 2 to 3 years hanging out probably every day. We partied together and we used to hang out at Jay's house and play euchre in his kitchen, and he would always have hash, and his favorite way was hot knives, meaning his favorite way to smoke. I never once met his parents, they were never home. We went to see the Rolling Stones together and always had a ton of fun. Jay was always super chill, very quiet, always played pro line at the variety store, so was always a gambler. I remember once he drove to my house, which was about 20 minutes from his house, for $3, so he would have enough to make his pro line picks. I never saw him angry. He was always in a good mood, and when I found out that he did this to his wife, I was literally floored. I couldn't believe it. It just didn't fit his personality. But I guess the quiet ones always fool you. For reference, I was born in 1976, so Jay is a few years older than me. And by the time this happened, we had spread out into different groups, so my knowledge of him is just from way back. But I've had several friends that stayed in contact with Jay, and it was a mutual friend of ours that I believed introduced him and Paula. I know from speaking with a close friend of mine that this friend also defended Jay until the end and was so hurt when he found out that Jay was capable of such a terrible crime. Never in my life would I have thought I could have spent so much time with someone who could have done such a thing. I for sure never saw that coming, and made me question my ability to choose friends, that's for sure, even years later." Then they say, quote, "My heart truly goes out to all Paula's family and Jay's friends and family that were so hurt and deceived by what he did. So thank you so much to this person for providing their little tidbit." I think specifically it's just so interesting to hear, how do you react when someone that you thought you knew as a friend or a brother-in-law or an uncle or whatever, and suddenly they do something like this, and your immediate reaction might be to be like, no, there's no way. And to say he, you know, I never saw him get angry and he was, you know, super chill. It's like, how does one person change that much?
Mm-hmm.
And just decide one day that they're going to kill their wife?
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's truly terrifying.
But that's the thing with these psychopaths and sociopaths. They are so good at just blending into society when really, behind closed doors, you don't know what's going on through this person's head. You don't know what he's thinking every time he looks at his wife, the thoughts that are going through his mind that he never speaks about.
Mm-hmm.
It's so eerie to think that you can be fooled by somebody who is so seemingly normal, who, you know, was a childhood friend of yours, who you have all these fun, happy memories with, who would you would never, ever suspect would be capable of doing something like this.
Yep.
And once again, it just goes back to the thought that we think that we know who these people are. We think we can pick out the crazies from the group. And, oh, I would know because my instinct would tell me if this person is dangerous. And clearly it's not the case. And once you find out that, you know, this person is guilty, the friend that I thought I knew is actually capable of committing murder, I personally would be going back through every single memory that I have in my head with this person and analyzing everything. Like, oh, when, you know, when we were hanging out and doing this and that, was I, you know, did I say something to anger him? And did he look at me in a certain way? And was I getting any weird feelings from him back at this time? Like, my mind would just be spinning, I think.
Yeah. I literally cannot even imagine, and I hope I never have to.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, really unreal. And this poor girl, Anna, was left without both of her parents. Just so tragic. And thank goodness for Paula having such an amazing, dedicated family.
Mm-hmm.
And her sisters who fought for her until the end. And who knows, honestly, what would have happened if they weren't there.
Exactly.
Keeping her name in the media and increase the award and keep the award. And, you know, it's just surreal. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it happened so close to home.
Yeah.
Is crazy.
Yeah.
So we're going to wrap it up there. And we just wanted to, as always, say thank you so much to our listeners for all of your support and your patience and messaging us on Instagram and leaving us comments and follows and reviews and ratings and all that stuff. It really, truly does mean so much to us that you're supporting our little podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it makes our day. It makes our week.
Yes. Another side note too is, in case you didn't hear it on our last episode, we do have merch available now, which is in the link on our bio and our Instagram. And last episode, we were saying about how the shipping is a little pricey, and now we have secured completely free shipping within Canada. So definitely go take advantage of that. It is so amazing. And
we have so many good things on there.
Like, yeah.
Get yourself a full sweatsuit, get mm-hmm. yourself a tumbler, get yourself a mug, get yourself a little air freshener for your car.
Honestly, like, I just want everything, and it's just, it's going to be my entire personality going forward. My entire wardrobe is just going to be mama side merch.
Again, thank you so much to everybody who has purchased already.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even wrap my mind around someone wearing our logo.
I know.
It's so freaking cool.
Yeah.
So
definitely send us pictures, because that literally makes our day seeing you guys wearing that stuff.
Frame them and put them up on our walls and look at them every day.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for listening. And next case is who?
Next case, I will be telling the story of Adam Strong from Oshawa, Ontario, which has been actually pretty highly requested by some of our followers on our massive case request list. His name has come up quite a few times. And really, I didn't know. I don't think either of us really knew who he was. And upon looking into it, he is effed up and repulsive and disgusting to his absolute core. So
prepare yourselves.
Yeah, it's a little hard for me to stomach even researching this case, to be quite honest. But I mean, you guys will be in for another gruesome story. So get ready.
We will see you next time.
See you guys next time.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.